are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Mother Nature and Lisa's Drafting Issues to Protect Against Storms and Other Damage. I am pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Philadelphia is Richard Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg is a retired partner of Ballard Spahr LLP. Mr. Goldberg has more than 40 years' experience in real estate and law practice and with a major national developer. He is past president of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and past chair of the Anglo-American Real Property Institute. He is a fellow of the American College of Mortgage Attorneys. Mr. Goldberg will serve as the leader of today's program. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner of Taft, Stennis & Hollister LLP, where he formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Mr. Goldberg, I am pleased to hand the program over to you.
Well, thank you, Ian, and welcome everybody. In the next hour, Tony and I are going to talk about the casualties. The recent Notre Dame disaster is evidence of the fact that almost anything can happen to anybody, any place, at any time, and I doubt that that's under any kind of lease. So our conversation is not going to be applicable, but it is a really evident demonstration of the fact that casualty can happen, and Tony and I have both experienced significant issues with casualty. We're going to talk about the clauses, lease clauses. We're going to talk about force majeure. We're going to talk about fire. We're going to talk about how to draft, and give you a kind of a major overview of how the casualty clauses work and how they come into play and how they need to fit in with each other, which will include things like where should rent abatement occur, and how do you handle it, and how do you handle it vis-a-vis insurance. Tony, let's start talking about rent under a casualty. Do you want to talk a little bit about the covenants to pay rent?
Sure, Dick. Always great to be with you on a panel. The important thing to start with is a little legal background from those of you who may not remember your property class teaching. Historically, and I think this is probably because the king owned most of the property and rented it to everybody else, at common law, there was something called the doctrine of independent covenants. And you recall that under that doctrine, the tenants' covenant to pay rent was independent of any obligation on the part of the landlord to provide any space. So the tenant at common law did not get relief from its obligation to pay rent, even if the building or the structure that you were renting was destroyed. So that was a very harsh result, but that's the way it was that's why they always say it's good to be the king. Eventually, the law began to evolve away from that as more commerce came into place and leases all around the world were commonly done. And in a lot of states, as I understand it, various states have adopted the so-called implied warranty of habitability. Under that doctrine, you get a concept that the space has to be habitable. And therefore, if the landlord, if there's been a casualty or some other occurrence and the premises become unoccupiable and your state happens to have adopted the implied warranty of habitability, you may have the ability to get out of paying the rent if you're a tenant. And again, if you're a landlord, you're not so crazy about that, which is why we're going to then take up a whole series of lease clauses, because you don't want, as a general rule, Dick, I think it's fair to say, to be left to the remedies and rights that you might get at common law in the various states. You should always try to have a lease that deals with these issues properly, and that's really what our main focus is in our discussion today.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Obviously, when you talk about whether something is habitable or not, I think in most cases it has to be fully non-habitable in order to qualify for abatement of the rent in those states that have adopted it. In other words, if you can use it in some fashion, you may not be able to get the benefit of the habitability relief that you get. I think you have to be very careful about that. I think it is much. This is probably one of the. There are two things about this section. One, it should be one that both parties pay a lot of attention to. But number two, it's one that I've never loved negotiating. Don't ask me why. I just have, a kind of anathema to. To negotiating the technicalities of it, and I would I would tell you also in my experience, it's under-negotiated. Most people have the same feeling about it and don't really spend enough time really reviewing the casualty provisions and the possibilities that can occur. Take a couple moments out for two war stories, one of Tony's and one of mine. The developer that I was with was called the Rouse Company in Columbia, Maryland. It was one of the it was one of the largest and most prestigious real estate companies, mainly engaging in malls, but it did also office and residential and hotels and things of that nature. First joined in 1970. I joined it about a month after. An entire shopping center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, mall, a closed regional mall, burnt to the ground. And I spent the first 2 years of my life negotiating the insurance settlement, trying to deal with the question of how it worked and how it was going to work. I will tell you, it was a major issue. There were two department stores. They both were wiped out. And it all started because of a coffee pot that was left on overnight during by workmen in a 2,000-foot store that was being renovated. And I learned very, very important lessons about what you could do and couldn't do and how insurance worked. Tony, you want to go into your story?
This is many years ago in Chicago, 1992, and I was a lawyer actually helping to run a property at the request of a client, major property in Chicago. Chicago has a series of underground freight tunnels that date back to the 1800s, and that tunnel system is connected to many buildings in the city. Well, one day, and that the tunnels run underneath the river, one day they were doing work in the river and they were driving pilings for a bridge support. They punctured the tunnel and the river started flooding the tunnel, and all the water actually filled the tunnels and then started coming up the access connections and flooded out a number of major buildings in the city down in the sub-basement level and the basement level, where, of course, most of the electrical equipment is for the building. So the point is, you don't just have to worry about fire. You have to worry about all kinds of potential casualties that can strike a property. And that one was certainly a disaster. And there was years of litigation that ensued over who was going to bear the loss between the landlord and the tenant when the spaces were inaccessible, although the spaces themselves were not damaged. And we'll touch on that in the drafting about important to distinguish between those two situations. Dick, one thing we might want to touch on here at the outset, again, as we turn to the specific clauses, is that it's generally the case in most drafting protocol that the landlord will be the party who is supplying the first draft of the lease. Typically, the landlord has multiple tenants in a building, and so they want to have consistency with the leases. So they will have typically in an office building or a mall or certainly in an apartment building, but in a more commercial setting, which is really what we're focused in on here today. Always remember, if your tenant's counsel, that form that you're going to be looking at is a pro-landlord form, and it will need tinkering in ways we'll talk about today to protect tenants And that doesn't necessarily mean that when we say protect tenants, it necessarily means that it makes it bad for the landlord. What we try to get to in most of these situations, and Dick, I know you've had over your years of experience gotten it to this point too, we want to get to commercially reasonable situations, and you want commercially reasonable clauses so that risks are properly allocated and insured against and people are protected so that one side or the other doesn't bear all of the catastrophe that might befall a particular property.
I think that's right, Tony, and this is one where, in fact, really one of the most important things that you can think of is there's no particular advantage to anybody being unfair in this kind of situation. Let's forget the question of tenant relations and the ability to get rent or not get rent. When there is a casualty, the first thing you need to think about, you need to look at, is the strength or lack of strength of your insurance. And you have to be very, very careful about the insurance. Let's forget the question of rebuilding. Let's talk about one of the most important pieces of insurance, which is, in fact, rent and business abatement insurance. And if you're not very, very careful, I will suggest to you that rental abatement insurance, business interruption insurance, or rental interruption insurance is really kind of a following form policy. And you better make sure that the risk that you're talking about is covered under the underlying property policy. I'll give you an example. When I was with the Rouse Company, the developer, we were the developer of South Street Seaport. South Street Seaport was built partially on land and then partially on a pier. And the pier flooded. And as a result of the flood of the pier, all of the while the stores were inhabitable, we had the same issue that Tony had, which was a question of the ability to, the utilities went out. And there was a great discovery that because this was a flood situation and was not necessarily covered under the policy, that there was a gap. And clearly there was not, there may not have indeed been insurance to cover everybody under rent abatement or business abatement. And we in our lease really provided, in the event that utilities were wiped out, after a couple of days we would start to do rent abatement. I will tell you, after that we changed the form lease and did not do rent abatement, and suggested to the tenants that the tenants had to come up with their own methodology of doing it, because we were out for about 3 weeks in a major New York destination. So again, you need to, when you look at the first item I would really suggest to anybody who does this kind of work is, by all means, you must look at the terms and provisions of your insurance to make sure that, in fact, the insurance conforms with what you're doing as part of your lease. Otherwise, you may find yourself in a serious anomaly that you don't want to find, that you don't want to be in. So this is not just, let me draft this thing and see how it works out. You need to really, really coordinate your insurance coverage along with that which you're doing with the with the rent. So, with your clauses.
Right. So, Dick, let me just mention in this regard, we run into this all the time, particularly when we're training younger lawyers. Lawyers in general, and I'm guilty of this in my career too, have a tendency to not be very interested in insurance. As you progress along your career, you begin to realize how critical it is that you actually have good working knowledge of what these policies say and what the exclusions are and so forth. And my advice to lawyers generally is you can't just simply say, pick up the phone, call the agent and say, hey, I just want to make sure we're covered for business interruption, right? And the agent says, yeah, you've got that coverage. And the lawyer has a tendency to say, okay, fine. And you make a note in your file that you talked to the agent. He said, we're covered. Well, you might find out later on, as Dick is suggesting, that what you're covered for isn't what you thought you were covered for, and you really have to make sure that as part of the process that the client and the agent and yourself are all on the same page with what is covered by that insurance.
Yeah, that's very, very true. I've done a number of insurance programs for web credenza, and it is absolutely essential that you are careful about understanding insurance. And most lawyers, frankly, are not careful and don't understand how insurance is supposed to work.
Yep.
It really is a big kind of issue. And something that essential at least you familiarize yourself. And funny, Tony, because the article that I've written always starts with, "Let's call the insurance agent." And then it tells you why you shouldn't call the insurance agent. Because, you know, to tell you the truth, they are not necessarily as familiar with this, any more familiar with this than you are as an agent. And you need to really understand how this is supposed to work. We had I was working on actually a loan for a major design center in Boston that was leased from the Redevelopment Authority, and the lender, the borrower, was relying on the Redevelopment Authority's insurance to cover them. And unfortunately, the redevelopment, we discovered in doing an insurance analysis that while all these years, while they were relying on the Redevelopment Authority's insurance, the Redevelopment Authority didn't have any. They covered them. They were a major, and this was a major developer, a major Texas developer whose name I won't tell you, but you would recognize it almost instantly if you've been doing this for any length of time. And so, again, it's a very, very interesting kind of thing, but don't feel, you should not feel that you shouldn't know anything about insurance. You're making a mistake if you do. I'm sorry about that little venture, but I think it is essentially very important. Shall we go on?
Sure. You want to take up some specific insurance or some specific lease clauses that are critical in this issue of what happens when Mother Nature deals you a nasty storm, Katrina or something? So
shall we start with force majeure, which is
a
very interesting topic and often misunderstood. First of all, if you simply put in your lease, this lease shall be subject to force majeure, believe it or not, and I don't recommend it, by the way, but believe it or not, what you have just done is it is not just a quiet little statement that you've made. And in fact, there are definitions of force majeure that if you say that, a court can find that they understand what you're talking about without you being very, very specific about what a force majeure is. And a force majeure is something more than an act of God. Let's understand that. An act of God is an event of force majeure, but a force majeure does not only contain deal with acts of God. It deals with any number of other kinds of elements. But there is if you go down to any one of the Black's Law Dictionary, or for those of you who are old enough to remember Words and Phrases, which was I always found to be a relatively valuable shortcut to a research tool. In fact, there are force majeure is really defined. So if you really want to be careful about how you do this, you really need to draft your force majeure clause. And what is force majeure? Force majeure really, and I don't know, I can't tell you what the interpretation is. I can't tell you what it necessarily means in French. But I will tell you that force majeure really includes things that are out of the control of the parties that occur, that will rise to the level of having certain situations come to play if things happen that are out of the party's control. I mean, that's the best thought and best definition I can come up with, Tony. If you have a better one, I'd be delighted to hear it.
And people in leases will typically start off with things, but they can include such things as strikes, acts of war, material shortages. All kinds of things like that could and if you went, and I'm sure there are law review articles about what is force majeure, what isn't, because I'm sure there's cases over the years, Dick, that have been litigated about you know, something happened and one party or the other is trying to escape their obligations, and they're now claiming that their duty to perform, and it could be on either side, but their duty to perform has been forgiven or at least postponed due to the occurrence of what is a force majeure event. So from the point of view of a draftsman, draftsperson working on a force majeure clause, that first critical issue is what all is in the definition of it, and we've just given you several examples of things that you might not normally expect. Acts of war. By the way, that acts of war clause is important, Dick, because there was this little event called 9/11. Some of you may remember, and there were a lot of litigation flowed out of whether or not a terrorist attack was an act of war. So a lot of clauses now, since then, have been amended to include acts of terrorism as an item of force majeure.
Well, the other one that really occurs to me, by the way, was that which occurred after the death of the great Martin Luther King, and all the rioting that occurred in the cities. I happened to be my initial career was in the Baltimore City Solicitor's Office before I went to work for the developer that I worked for. And the city of Baltimore was shut down and under troops, and we ultimately the city litigated and won a case that said that lost a case that said that the insurance coverage was not available under these circumstances because these were you know
acts. It was a riot.
Civil disturbance,
right?
Yeah, and so you know again this is all very very applicable to that which you're trying to accomplish, and it is not to be neglected. And I would spend a little bit of time. If you don't know what force majeure is, it could take you about 20 minutes to figure out all those things that if you don't define it, will come under the auspices of the term force majeure.
Right.
But again, the principal elements are things out of people's control. And they are particularly war, civil disturbance, acts of God, fire, because the question is whether fire is not normally viewed as an act of God, flood, and other kinds of similar kinds of hazards, and frankly, when you're dealing with leases, there's really a very very important distinction that needs to be made. When I represent landlords, the introduction to my force majeure clause is relatively simple. It simply says that except for force majeure will apply in every case, but I start off with the statement except for the payment of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very very simple. In other words, I do not. Force majeure can prevent construction activities, but if you have a force majeure in your lease that applies to things other than your construction or things of that nature, which is the most frequent application of force majeure. Notwithstanding that, you do not want to impair the payment of money. And again, I think that's a fairly critical drafting point. If you were if you're the landlord, you want to make sure that if money gets paid to you, it will get paid to you. On the other hand, you also want to make sure that, in fact, if it's a tenant allowance doesn't get paid when a force majeure event occurs. Has that been your experience, Tony?
Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to mention at the outset is that you have to be careful, obviously, with the force majeure clause, because sometimes people will stick that force majeure clause, Dick, in a section of the lease that is talking about build-out. What's the landlord going to build? What is the tenant going to build? And then there's a clause that says if either side's delayed or obstructed by a force majeure event, then they'll have a definition of what is force majeure. Then their build-out obligations are postponed, which means maybe paying for the build-out or completing the build-out or delivering on time. But the key point here is that you have to make sure that the force majeure clause that is in the build-out section isn't just limited to the build-out. Nick. You want to make sure, I know, to have it apply to the whole lease, not just the build-out clause. So that's my first pointer on that. Make sure that, because you'll often find that clause nested in the build-out section
right.
of the lease.
But they may, it may
to
have...
The miscellaneous, it belongs in the miscellaneous provisions yeah. section. We could talk, by the way, for a 30-second digression. I think a lot of us, when we're reading a big, long lease document, Dick, when we get to that miscellaneous provision, mm-hmm. we have a tendency to start flipping pages. Don't flip too quickly. Read some of those clauses. In particular, if there's a force majeure provision, it might be lurking in that miscellaneous section.
I mean, I was an adjunct at Temple University, and I taught a skills course, which is a kind of which is, you first of all you have nothing but you have nothing in that but you know 3 L's, and I taught it in the spring, and therefore they were ready to cash out and in fact become. Go out into the world, and so this course was in part, in fact, treating them, not only doing a skills course, but trying to get them to deal with the world. And we taught, we negotiated and drafted leases, and that's how the course was constituted. And we spent several days on the miscellaneous section in the lease that we provided. Because
good for you.
We said to him, this is a bad description. This is not miscellaneous, folks. And we went through things like force majeure,
holding over,
operation of law, which law should be regarded. It is, and force majeure is of course implicated in many of those leases. So.
Right.
I would, do not underemphasize the notion of looking at that. I agree with you, Tony.
Right. Dick, one last thing we ought to touch on, two last things, I guess, on the force majeure. One of them is, and I've, in preparing for this, I just went and picked up a lease that somebody had sent me just this week to review. And I looked at the force majeure clause, and the doggone thing says that the landlord shall not be in default if there's a force majeure event, but it doesn't apply to the tenant. And so you want to make sure when you read these clauses that you're thinking when you're reading it and say, wait a minute, why is that the landlord only? It really should excuse both parties. And if you aren't careful, that clause will say landlord is excused, and it may explicitly say tenant is not excused. And obviously, if you're tenant counsel, you can't countenance that.
Yeah, I think you can just take as a glittering generality that everybody's form lease will have all obligations on tenants and will have all excuses on landlords as a matter of form. And that's one of the first things you go through is make sure that you change all that if you're representing the tenant. Now, I spent most of my life representing landlords, so I'm not necessarily a huge advocate of that as a way of life. But form leases are form leases, and form leases are generally drafted by landlords. And I think
right.
Tony's absolutely right. You need to be very, very careful.
If you're tenant counsel.
If you're tenant counsel.
Right. Now, one last thing on force majeure, Dick, and we ought to get off of this then, I think,
sure.
is to move on, is that it's very common in these force majeure clauses to have language about time periods. In other words, it'll frequently say you have to notify the other side within 2 days of an event occurring which you are interpreting to be force majeure and therefore excusing your performance. And somewhere in that miscellaneous section is probably a time is of the essence clause. And a lot of courts, Dick, I find, are very sticky about that. If you have time limits in those force majeure clauses, make sure that you're on top of that and don't dilly-dally about sending notices that might be required, because otherwise you might find yourself defending on the grounds that the clause at least said time is of the essence and you had so many days to notify them and we were slow in getting that done, and you might lose the benefit of that protection that you went so much trouble to put into your force majeure provision. Don't let that happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things that that I've kind of generally figured on. Number one, I look at time periods, and number two, if a letter of credit is involved, I make sure that I don't have to make, they don't pick a city for presentation where I have to make three changes of planes. And, you know, those are kinds of things you need to think about when you're looking at time, but especially time periods, because they, you know, again, landlords are much more adept at dealing with time periods because that's their, that is their business. Whereas tenants have other things to deal with other than landlords, periods of time and excuse. So I think, Tony, you've made an excellent point. Why don't we move on? Should we talk about casualty clauses in general? Casualty clauses in general will, of course, you know, talk about several things. We'll define what a casualty is, which will, as we notice, will include force majeure, but will include other things. They indeed may include other things that otherwise would be defined as force majeures, as a force majeure event, other than you, in fact, they'll do it, they'll repeat it for the sense of repeating it. And then we'll talk about what happens when there's a casualty, what benefits and detriments do each of the parties have, and then they will finally end up talking about what happens and who has to do what to cure all of these events. Now, those are really the composition of the casualty clause. And the first thing I think you need to bear in mind is that you know, number one, under what circumstances do the parties have the right to terminate a lease because of a casualty, and what kind of casualty can result in a termination, and the length of time of fixing the casualty, how will that result in a termination? And the second critical question, and then the question is who cures and who gets to do what. And then the final question, of course, is what happens to the payment, the non-payment of rent under those circumstances. That's the typical composition of a casualty clause. And they really are kind of all over the place. And of course, you know, landlords are not necessarily except in big box leases, which are a whole different subject than normal office building or other kinds of tenancy leases. You know, landlords don't typically have obligations to carry insurance in their leases. It doesn't happen that often or that frequently. But tenants are obligated. And I think the critical question is, what happens when this occurs? You know, obviously, if you can't do business, the deal ought to call if you're representing a tenant for rent abatement. It is really, if I can't use the premises for that which we intended me to use the premises for during the course of our lease negotiations, there should be some form of rent abatement. I will tell you that normally rent abatement doesn't start on day one, at least in my experience. The rent abatement will frequently start, you know, after a period of time. It could be as little as 2 days, but in fact, it is not, you know, the first time around, the first day. And then the rent abatement, then people will begin to start to think about their insurance, and they will have either business interruption insurance, or if you're a landlord, you're going to have rental interruption insurance. But I made the point to you earlier that I think is really critical, and that is that you better look very, very carefully if you're both a landlord and a tenant, and what rent abatement, what business interruption or rent abatement insurance covers, because it only covers perils that are insured under the policy. It does not cover things that are not insured under the policy, and I think that's a relatively critical fact that most people don't understand. And my South Street Seaport thing was a great example of where this particular kind of thing was not covered under rental abatement, because if you recall that rental and floods are may be a separate policy. And if you're not careful, your ability to get flood insurance can be limited by your ability to get rental and abatement insurance may not include
flood.
The flood right. that can arise. So and if it doesn't, you're out of luck. You're not gonna collect, and it's not gonna work.
Dick, we should remind our listeners that there are thousands of lawyers in America who earn a living doing something known as coverage counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And what coverage counsel do is they try to find ways that the insurance company doesn't have to pay because the policy doesn't cover whatever it is that the claim is. So, like Dick says, don't assume that the insurance coverage is going to be there just because the agent told you you're covered. You need to dig into that and make sure you're taking care on that. Those
well,
or at least tell the client to do it.
The wonderful thing is that when I happened to have made the dreadful mistake, which I said I would never do, of being the president of my condo association. And oddly enough, we have, and that was done out of self-preservation. And oddly enough, we had some work done, and a tenant, an occupant, an owner-occupant, decided to file a complaint alleging mismanagement with the Pennsylvania Attorney General, which is a recent amendment to the Condo Act in Pennsylvania and in other places as well. And we presented the claim to our O&D policy, since it alleged mismanagement by the directors. And I will tell you that the denial of coverage letter is longer than the complaint he filed. They are defending us,
yes.
But they reserved all their rights.
Oh, sure,
they had a 14-page letter.
Right.
I'm still reading it. This happened six months ago, so you all can guess what the story is. But yes, I mean you have to be very, very, very careful about this. But again, bear in mind that when you're representing, this is a landlord. The landlord will draft the lease. What you really need to cover as a tenant to me are the following things. You need to make sure, number one, how long does the rent abate? Number one, who does the restoration and who's responsible for what restoration? For example, trade fixtures, landlord fixtures that get installed are landlord fixtures. When I was with Rouse, we as a cost saver made the tenant insure all of their fixtures, that the fixtures did not become part of the property until the lease terminated. It was a little trick, but it saved us when you have, 100 regional malls. It saves you a fair amount of insurance. And
yep.
You need to really, really make sure what is going to, what is going to happen and who's covering what. Number two, who's obligated to do what under the lease? Who restores? In office buildings are different than malls, and malls are different than residences in how it works. But for the most part, the landlord should be restoring the basic premises, and the tenant should be recreating its space, its own fixtures. If you're a law firm, you want to design your offices. You may indeed use this opportunity to redesign the offices. As many of you know, the art of designing law firms has changed over the years. You don't have massive corner offices anymore, and you have a real, a real shortening of space. Offices are getting smaller. I know in this city that offices for partners and associates are smaller than they used to be, and there's more common space. So if you're the tenant, you don't want the landlord to, may not want the landlord to put back exactly what you had. You may want to be able to develop a set of new plans. And how does that work? Or are they only obligated to restore what you had? And so that's an interesting question, that whether you can go through a design phase. In a retail lease, it's clear that if you're the retailer, you must redesign your own store. and you will be responsible for refixturing and doing all those things that you know are unique to yourself, because every store is different. Even though when you walk briskly through a shopping center, they kind of tend to look the same. They are all really different and unique and reflect the brand of the retailer. So these are clauses that where you have to really be. You just don't let it sit. You really need to read it and decide whether or not the proposal for rebuilding fits the needs and desires of your client. A good example in retailer is when retailers decide to remodel and the store that gets damaged under a casualty was due to be remodeled next year. You don't want them to rebuild what you had necessarily, because you want to be able to, you know, to take advantage of this, oddly enough, to put your new design and your new imprint on the premises.
Right.
So,
Dick, let me suggest a few specific things that people should be, I think, always sensitive to and looking out for. If that's okay, the first one would be, pay attention when you're looking at these casualty clauses to make sure that they have distinguished between damage to the building versus damage to the premises. And what I'm talking about there is you might have a fire, you might have a flood, you might have some other catastrophic occurrence, which, say, only affects the ground floor. But the result of that is nobody can get up into the space. And so in a typical situation like that, you want the landlord obligated to rebuild as quickly as you can, and the rent ought to abate while your access is denied. The alternative to that is you need a separate section typically that talks about what happens if there's damage, typically fire, but other damages can occur, to the premises that the tenant is renting. And there, as Dick has indicated, you have to take care to allocate rebuilding responsibility again between what's the landlord responsible to rebuild and what is the tenant responsible to rebuild. And one of the key things is the termination clause, which typically kicks in if the premises are so seriously destroyed that it's a major rebuilding job. And often you'll see that expressed as a percentage, Dick, as you know, of the percent of the premises affected. In other words, 60% or more of the space or some percentage like that, then various termination rights kick in. Sometimes it's expressed, and commonly this termination right is expressed as a time estimated to repair the damage. In other words, these clauses will say if the damage is such that it takes longer than 180 days to repair, then either side may terminate. Well, you might read that and think, well, that's not so bad. Let's talk about a couple practical realities in that situation. Practical reality number one, if you've never been through this, and I hope and pray that none of you ever do, but odds are if you practice long enough, sooner or later it's going to strike you. Reality number one in that time period, Dick, is something known as the adjuster has to show up. You've probably been through this many times with me. Getting the adjuster to come up with a quote to do the repairs and what the insurance company is going to pay is not a brief experience. And in fact, depending on, I was involved in a significant restaurant fire once, and it took a long time to get an estimate of what that was going to cost to rebuild. Had another fire situation where it took several months for the parties to be able to agree. So if you only have 180 days before those termination rights kick in, and you've piddled away, you know, 90 of them trying to get a settlement with the insurance company, you know, that could be a bad situation. Number two, even if you can then figure out what the insurance company is going to pay towards the rebuilding process, you still have to get the plans prepared. Don't forget, you probably got to get a building permit on those plans. So typically, in my experience, Dick, these time periods never can be complied with when you lay out the realities of having to get an adjustment, having to get plans drawn, having to get permits, having to do pricing with contractors, and then actually do the construction. So just be prepared for the reality that those time periods may not be long enough. Where that's critical, Dick, I think, to a tenant or representing a tenant, is that it's often the case that the tenant is spending significant dollars on the build-out of their space. And I think of restaurants where you have extremely large infrastructure improvements, which are typically paid for by tenants. Often they're financed in some respect by various landlord build-out allowances, but then the rebuilding obligation may be on the tenant. So, Dick has alluded to law firms. Typically, law firm spaces are another area where we've had issues around very expensive build-outs are medical offices, Dick.
Right.
You know, because you typically
dental
have
offices.
And any kind of medical offices, just for the benefit of our listeners, always is a complicated rebuild or original build or rebuild, because you tend to have lots of small examining rooms, each of which has to have plumbing in it, right, Dick? So,
right.
You know, you think about a law firm set of offices, nobody's got plumbing except, you know, in the kitchen and in the washrooms. In a medical office, you got plumbing all the way through the whole space. So that's a very expensive build out. And again, you need to have that time period in the casualty clause reflect the reality of what it may take to rebuild the exact space that you're going to be dealing with on behalf of your client. I have a client that is a not-for-profit, and they have a library. And we have all kinds of provisions in that thing, because we've got bookshelves and storage, and we've got fire suppression materials and all kinds of stuff. And so if there was, God forbid, a fire in that library, it would be quickly put out. But the damage, by the way, that's a quick aside, if you ever had much experience in dealing with fires, for our listeners, typically it is the case that the bulk of the cost associated with repair has to do not so much with the fire itself, but it's the smoke and all the water. Chemicals that they dumped on it to try to put it out. So the damage can be extensive. It doesn't take much of a fire to run up a big bill, and the time period to get all that restored can be significant.
You know, it's interesting. My dentist was in an old building. It was the Philadelphia Stock Exchange in the early 1800s that was being renovated, and they had a water break, and his entire office got ruined. And I would sit in the chair, and he knew I was a real estate lawyer, and all I could go, while he is recanting to me how much he hates lawyers, landlords, utility companies, and everybody else, because he was out of business for 9 months. Imagine the amount of equipment that a dental office contains, which, quite aside from all the plumbing and everything else, it's also the issue of the equipment. And replacing the equipment and what you can replace, because every year the equipment gets more modern. It is, we lawyers can only sit down and try to set a backdrop for what's going to happen. The reality of life is that in most casualty situations that I've seen, that which we draft isn't really what happens. But what you really have to start to think about is to contemplate the notion that you're giving people enough time to get the work done, and also let's take something else into significant consideration. Markets come and go, and if there's a casualty and a termination right, somebody is going to be advantaged. If you have a rising market, a market where rents are getting more expensive, you need to be careful representing a tenant that the landlord can't just willy-nilly decide that they're going to take advantage of this and get more rent from you or make you move and get more rent from a new tenant. Likewise, not everything goes up. We've been very, very lucky in the last number of years, and I'm just sitting here waiting for the reverse shoe to fall. If a market is declining, you may be a tenant that wants to indeed, you know, find new space or at least get a rental reduction. And the casualty is, frankly, I hate to put it this way, but it is a really excellent opportunity for that to occur. So I'd be really careful about how you draft the termination rights. Even, you know, even if you have a situation where you're totally out of business as a tenant, you can get back in business. You can find temporary, you know, quarters. And obviously, for retailers, they can, you know, it's different than for doctors, lawyers, and, you know, and accountants and office buildings. But notwithstanding that, you do not want, you want to protect yourself against being terminated for, you know, for market, you know, important market swings in the in the businesses, and it's, right, it's not easy to do because you can't, you know, we draft, we can't contemplate all kinds of circumstances. You know, it's interesting. Tony, in previewing this program, talked about the question of whether or not you should. What happens if the fire is, quote, caused by the tenant?
Yeah. It's not unusual. It's a great point, Dick. It's not unusual in these clauses, as Dick knows and we've seen, that sometimes the remedies that are afforded to the tenant, such as the ability to abate the rent and to terminate if the casualties is so significant that it requires a total rebuild and you can't wait to do that and you have to go establish your business somewhere else. Not unusual in some leases to see a clause that says those remedies afforded to the tenant do not apply if the tenant was the cause of the fire. In other words, if some employee, you know, tossed a cigarette into a trash can, mm-hmm, or, you know, some wiring in the tenant's space, or, you know, somebody was cooking and accidentally set the fire. And so you don't want that clause, obviously, if a tenant, and then I've always objected to it as a tenant, and as on the landlord side, I usually give in on that right away. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, candidly, if everybody is properly insured, the whole function of insurance, and we could give a whole lecture someday, Dick, on subrogation clauses,
mm-hmm,
but the whole function of insurance and the waiver of subrogation and so forth is to let the risk of the loss be borne by the insurance companies that are paid to take that risk and spread that risk over a large body of premium payers who are, you know, in effect sharing the risks collectively, as opposed to sticking the poor tenant if the somebody working for the tenant accidentally causes the fire or the other casualty. So,
and the same thing is true on the landlord,
yeah,
side, by the way. The landlord,
yes,
you know, also, if they're responsible, which may in fact occur more often than not,
yep,
the landlord says, let's, you know, I want the same rights. I want you to, you know, to deal with my, you know, with my insurance company, and you know, and you deal with yours, I'll deal with mine, and you can't sue me.
That's right.
And
the insurance carrier for either party can't sue the other party because, mm-hmm, they are subrogated to the claim that the other party would have had, and the insurance carrier now steps into their shoes. That's what,
right,
the whole waiver of subrogation is,
right,
all about. So,
right. And it's
Dick
very,
and our,
go ahead,
yeah,
Tony. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, as we're running down on time here, one other topic that I would think would be useful to call to folks' attention. There's a third category that I think is important to make sure is addressed in the leases, and that doesn't have to do necessarily with damages that are caused by to the building itself or to the premises. There's a whole category of issues that arise out of interruption, Dick, of utilities or other critical,
mm-hmm,
services. And let's face, in my example of the great Chicago flood in 1992, you know, the landlord wasn't at fault. This tenant wasn't at fault. And Mother Nature wasn't even at fault. Somebody drilling caissons in the river did it. But the point is that their utilities were knocked out for, in some cases, for, you know, a couple of weeks. Well, you have to pay rent if you can't even get in the elevators and go up to your space. No lights in the space, et cetera. And equally big issue, I think, is HVAC. You know, in a lot of cities, and depending on the, you know, how serious the winter is or how hot the summer is, HVAC in these enclosed buildings, that especially office buildings and retail malls that don't have windows, HVAC is essential to occupancy. Well, what happens if the HVAC system has had a major breakdown? So you'll typically see, in Dick, in my experience at least, you'll see clauses that say, listen, anything can happen that would cause an interruption of utilities or critical services for some brief period of time. That should not cause a rent abatement. But if that interruption of services that are being supplied to the space, whether by the landlord or by third parties in the case of utilities, if that interruption is so serious as to cause the space to be unoccupiable or unusable, and you see different negotiated time periods, 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, but if that occurs, then rent should abate because the tenant can't get in there and occupy it. And then if that's the case and you're the landlord, you want to be sure and tell your landlord client this clause is in there. If there's interruption of services, there may be rent abatement, and you should go have a conversation with your agent and your carrier about rental interruption insurance, and it should cover this particular situation. Dick?
Well, typically speaking, particularly in retail leases, we require business interruption insurance. So
yep.
There is a source of rent. Now, it's not a, you know, in when I go back into the earlier days where you used to have local merchants, you remember what they were. They're kind of a thing of the past. But local merchants, it was crucial because you didn't have to worry about things, people like, you know, the biggies, although now I think I'm more worried about the biggies than I am about the little guys. But the reality of life is that, again, make sure that you understand that the cause of the utility interruption has to be a covered risk under your policy. Otherwise, you will not get the benefit of the insurance. I think, Tony, it's time now to open the program to questions from our listeners. Ian, could you please provide our listeners with instructions as to how they can ask their questions?
If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touchtone phone, followed by the one key. That's star one. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Yeah, Tony, let me just ask you, this is not a legal question, but more of a style question. How cooperative have you seen over the years landlords and tenants when there is a casualty? Have you ever seen hostility, or do you typically see that they will cooperate with one another?
Well, I'd have to say in my experiences with this, generally people cooperate with each other because they obviously want to get the thing rebuilt and get it back up and running quickly, particularly if you have office buildings or retail malls where you tend to have large, the ownership may be in a REIT or some institutional investor who has a big portfolio, because reputations do, you know, word does get around, and so people want to be properly running their businesses and be cooperative and so forth. So I generally find pretty good cooperation. The one exception to that that I've seen, as I alluded to earlier, is this who caused the fire. And sometimes I have seen situations where if the tenant's people caused the fire, or tenant, somebody irresponsible working for the tenant caused the fire, I have seen a little more hostility in those situations. People start blaming the tenant for what happened, and this never should have happened, and you can get into some, and we're going to sue you for our damages, et cetera. You can get some hostility there. But by and large, and certainly I would say, we're talking about fire all the time, in these other Mother Nature types of situations, such as floods or serious wind damage from a hurricane, or terrorist type incidents or those kinds of things, I find people very cooperative because, let's face it, those are really either, sort of an act of God category, nobody's fault. We had a situation once where somebody, elderly person got confused and they stepped on the gas instead of the brake, and they drove their car through somebody's, showroom and had to deal with that. So, these things happen, and people, I've seen good cooperation when these unexpected occurrences, particularly as we've talked about in the program today, nobody was at fault for it. These are acts of God or acts not caused by the tenant or the landlord.
Yeah, I think that's been my experience. The time when there's also a lot of non-cooperation, I mentioned earlier, and that's when the market has radically changed. And then sometimes you will discover that they're not as cooperative as they should be, because the object is that they're losing money by staying in the space,
sure,
or losing money by rebuilding the space. Operator, are there any questions from our listeners?
And at this time, I'm showing that there are no questions over the phone lines.
Well, then, thank you, everyone. We're out of time. If you are not able to ask your question or one occurs to you later, you have Tony's info and my info in your packages and your written materials, and we'd be delighted to answer your question. This is Dick Goldberg, and on behalf of Tony LaCana and myself, thank you for joining us today.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's broadcast.